Reading from the Jiva Dharma, Chapter 1. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chaksurun Mulitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Amano Vishnam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadhamayam Dakti Sapadantikam Manchakopa Turubhyascha Kripa Shindu Bhayevicha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Sadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So greetings from Christchurch, New Zealand. I had a few minutes ago, what we call a super soul experience. You know, this is 18 hours ahead of New York. This is 2 p.m. in the afternoon on Thursday. So my schedule here, they're really taking very, very nice care of me. And it's kind of quite restful, but I'm giving classes morning and evening in the house where I'm staying. And the whole congregation, well, the good part of the congregation here comes to that. Unfortunately, their temple was destroyed in the earthquake. So it's reasonably busy, and it's wonderful. Good listeners, people who have been dedicated listeners of my sanghas and my tapes for years, quite a few people. And every morning from 7 to 8, 8:30, I speak, and in the evening from 7 to 9, 9:30, a little bit different on the weekends. So it's very regulated, you know. Lunch is every day at 1 o'clock, very simple. And then I take my walk. I was all dressed, ready to take my walk. I was walking outside, and then a voice in my heart said, maybe you got the time wrong. Because it's hard to calculate. I thought the class would be 3 p.m. That was my impression that I carried since yesterday, even telling other people. So somehow I rushed back in and checked the timings and didn't blow it. Now, you know, we missed the class yesterday. I told you how excited I am to be speaking on this Jiva Dharma. I think it's one of the most wonderful books by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Gail, do you remember where we were up to?
Yeah, actually I was trying to remember earlier. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I had just written a reminder to myself about who the principal characters were.
Anyway, I'll just relate the story and begin where I think it's to begin. So, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I mean, you can't say enough about him as a scholar. Even his schedule, we can use a term for anybody who really just is fully engaged in devotional service, minute by minute. You know, his service is Gail, maybe unmute your phone again or something. I'm hearing some static.
Mm-hmm.
Is Bhaktivinodian. You know, he was a district magistrate, which is practically like a governor, and he had 10 or 11 children. And, you know, he would sleep just a few hours and get up and chant and write. And he was quite creative. And this is kind of a novel. And the novel is about, and I have to give an introduction because we just put it out there. This may be the first time people are hearing it, and also there's a week gap. But it's an incredible story about people coming to bhakti, coming to Krishna consciousness, the generation after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu left. There may be still a few people at personal association with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And it's beautiful how it starts, you know, it gives a whole perspective of there's Bhumandala, this universe, and then there's Jambadweep, and with the Jambadweep then there's Bharatvarsha, which is the earth planet, and the earth planet then there's this Mayapur, Navadweep. Very, very special place. Nine islands of devotional service. And of those islands, one is called Godram Dweep. It happens to be the island that embodies and inspires and represents Kirtan. And, you know, it's very, very tropical and beautiful even today. And so within that place, there's a Sarabi Kunj, there's kind of forest bowers that are very, very excellent for bhajan. And there's many great saints in the tradition there. And there's one saint who's called Premdas Babaji or Babaji Maharaj. And he's a Param Vaishnav. He has prema. He has the love of Godhead. And of course, when you have prema, which is an intense desire, it's kind of like hunger is an intense desire, but when there's hunger, you don't have food. You feel you don't have food, and you don't have food. When you have prema, you have an intense desire for God in such a deep way that you feel you don't have God, but actually you have. You actually have prema. And it describes, you know, even his resonant his resonant voice would soothe the fire of people's hearts, and they would begin to cry in his association. Even in the Bhakti Sandarbha, it says that in the association of a Mahabhagavat, everyone will feel the influence, except those who have little knowledge and are proud. So the effect is there in their association. So the influence is very, very powerful. So he's in and he's just finished his rounds. He would chant 2 lakhs a day. And for people who are bhajananandi, there's goshtanandi, one who takes pleasure in Krishna consciousness with others more than by themselves. And then there's bhajananandi, one who takes more pleasure in Krishna consciousness by themselves than others, but it doesn't mean that they don't relish the association of others, but they're more solitary and reclusive. So he's in his kunj and he chants 2 lakhs, which was actually, that was the requirement. Even 50 years ago in Radha Kund, if anyone was really, really serious about Lila Smaran, about meditation, that was the basic prerequisite. Now, of course, they give it to anyone who has, it's kind of a bit of a sham. You get your, you know, it's called Ekadas Bhav Patra. You get a paper with your your spiritual identity and your form. These things manifest at a level of purity, but they somehow get this. And but previously, you had a chant 2 lakhs, 200,000 names a day, at least 128 rounds a day. So he would be chanting. When you chant like that, basically you're in that sublime association with God in the form of his name. He's there within his name. I was reading in the Yoga Sutras some commentaries, because when it describes that a recommended meditational object is Ishvara or God, when that object is meditated on with attention and love, and that object is signified by the syllables Om, Om, coming Om, coming right from the heart and proceeding up to the top of the head. Commentators ask, if the sound is prakritic or material, then how can it designate God? And the commentators just describe that, how can it be Ishvara or the controller? Well, they describe God sets the laws and he creates certain syllables which will be energized by God so that they become non-different than God. And the example is a beautiful example, an iron ball in fire. When you put an iron ball in fire, it becomes heat and light, which is the qualities of fire. So these syllables, these mantras, when chanted with purity, they become Ishwarized, Godized, Krishnized, like that. So it's that wonderful, wonderful, the iron ball, if it's in fire and it becomes heat and light, you hold it in your hand, you will be burned. You keep it in a dark room, it will illuminate it. So that's really, this meditation is so wonderful. When you meditate on the names of God, they spiritualize your consciousness. When you open your heart to them because of your faith, it will create a conduit to actually do something to your heart. And what it'll do, it'll infuse love within your heart. So he has just finished, and then when he finishes, he begins to read this book called Prema Vivart by one of Lord Chaitanya's associates, Jagadananda Pandit, which is rasa-laden. It describes purely what love is. And it's very humble, this Premdas Babaji, in when you're enthused or infused with devotion. Then you become very humble, because what you realize is that what you have attained cannot be attained by your effort. And if you think you can attain God by your effort, then that you can earn God by your effort, then how valuable can God be? And it's actually not God. If God can be earned by your effort, it's not actually God. God can be earned by your effort, it's not actually God. So when you have God, God in the form of the holy name. You feel mercy. And when you feel mercy, you feel humble. Because mercy indicates I do not deserve, I am not qualified. And the more mercy you receive, the more humble you become. And real mercy is feeling God within your heart. Real mercy is feeling love. And an overwhelming love that's actually the potency of God. And you'll be so happy you will not care about the ego, because that pleasure will be paltry in comparison. We're only concerned with the ego and senses because we're not experiencing the pleasure of divine love. And feeling an emptiness in our heart, we're trying to seek it elsewhere. But when you actually have that divine love in your heart, you are happy not to be the center. You're happy in any condition. Because it's overwhelming pleasure. And it reflects in your heart my lack of qualification for what I am getting. And therefore, someone with real bhakti is humble, and he's happy humble. So it's wonderful to get this description of this Babaji Maharaj. And as the story goes, just as he finishes his bhajan, and he kind of finishing, he opens his eyes, there's a sannyas there. And he offers respect because he's humble. And it's the culture of India to see God in those who are in positions of responsibility, because that's what they're supposed to carry in a superior position. So what happens is this, they have a very, very beautiful exchange. But the most important thing you understand in terms of Jiva Dharma is that so many people, it's going to be the story of people somehow or other coming and meeting Prem Das Babaji. And each one will be a different type of person that will come, and therefore will require a different type of instruction to enlighten them. This person is a Mayavadi impersonalist sannyasi. And therefore, for him to come to Krishna consciousness, it will require that he has some understanding of the difference between God and the soul. So that's a different, that's called a tattva, a particular subject in Krishna consciousness. And then a materialist will come. So he'll have to understand the difference between the soul and the body. And that the goal of life is not sense enjoyment. The impersonalist already knows that. So he doesn't need to be so instructed in that way. So basically, each person that comes will require a different element of the metaphysics of Krishna consciousness. And this way, as you go through the book, you get all the tattvas, Shakti tattva, Nam tattva, Jiva tattva. You get all these subjects of Krishna consciousness. And finally, there's a young man and his uncle who come, and they become fully Krishna conscious, and they begin to get instructed in bhakti. So you get the whole gamut of instruction in bhakti from the very beginning to the very end. So this is a very, very special book, and I'm kind of excited to, because also these classes are also my life, because I'm very busy now traveling, and lecturing. I have to have something to give, and I need to study. When you travel, the mode of study becomes a little bit difficult. But if you speak, at least my mind, when I speak, it really activates my intelligence. And it's what Prabhupada told Tamal Krishnamaraj when Tamal Krishna says, I don't have time to study, so we'll give class for 15 minutes. So this Sannyas Thakur comes, and he tells his story that he was at the highest stage of sannyas, there's Bahudak, Kudichak, and there's Parivrajakacharya, and there's Paramahamsa. So he's a Hamsa. Atmaramas Chimunayo Nigranat Abhyukrame. He's satisfied in heart. In one sense, he doesn't want anything material. In that sense. So he's a very detached, austere person. But having detachment, vairagya, it negates the suffering of sense gratification, but it doesn't give you the positive experience of love, of happiness. So he's actually there, and he's in Varanasi, and he's kind of completed so many different types of study, because the path of Gyan means what? Gyan is Vairagya, knowledge and detachment. It's you by your understanding and your consequent application of your understanding you're not the body, you're not the mind, you gradually cease to act according to the body and mind, which means you do no longer respond to the objects of attachment, and you work on it. And it's a very, very dry and arduous process, because there's no pleasure in renunciation. There's a goal of jnana and vairagya, which is moksha. So what's pleasurable is the goal. Because the goal is different than the practice. But in bhakti, there's no material objective. There's no goal for yourself. It's love. So it's a sukham kartam avyayam. It's very joyfully performed. So he's sitting there, and he's in that Zen impersonalist mood of renunciation, performing these arduous austerities, and then somehow or other, a pure devotee of Krishna, follower of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, comes by, and he's singing in ecstasy. And what is this kirtan? This kirtan is when the bhava or the devotion in the heart is manifest. So he's chanting, Gaur Nityananda Bho Haribo Haribo Gaur Nityananda Bho Haribo 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 Haribo. And the vibration of love from his heart. But this Sannyas Thakur, he's telling Babaji Maharaj how he came. He just, you know, did not want to break his meditation. But there's something that so deeply touched his heart. Brahmananda Brahmate Konya Bhagavan Jeev Guru Krishna Pasadi Pai Bhakti Lata Beej. Somehow or other, by the association of a pure devotee, the seed of prema, the seed of bhakti, the desire to love God as the highest expression of sublimity entered his heart, because he experienced it in that association. And he began to look for this Sannyas Thakur, this great devotee, and couldn't find him. And he wound up going to Vrindavan, and he was hearing about Rupa and Sanat, and he's 168 miles, he circumambulated. Then he heard about Navadvipa, because all the Vaishnavas were talking about Navadvipa, because they're all coming from Mayapur, because 500 years ago, Vrindavan was excavated by the followers of the six Goswamis. And they're coming from Bengal. So they're hearing about the Vrindavan means Bengal. It means the Bengali Vaishnavas, Jiva and Rupa and Sanatan, and Raghunath Das and Raghunath Bhatt. So somehow or other he has an inclination to go to Navadvip. And then he hears, because he's a spiritual seeker, and this is actually the practice of bhakti. The practice of bhakti is it begins in the heart, just like you want to worship the deity. You want to worship a form of God, it first manifests in your heart. And when you want the sadhu sangha, you first deeply pray in the heart to get the association of a great Vaishnava. And that's the way one finds Guru. And when that prayer in the heart, because there is a transcendental system, there is a transcendental system, which means God is in the heart, and God is also controlling the world. So from our heart, through that transcendental system, God can link us up with the devotees to fulfill our inner desires. And the experience when teaching here, I'm not here to do extensive outreach. I'm not here to do extensive outreach. I'm here for the devotees. Basically, I came here to speak Prem Bhakti, be it Bhagavatamrita and the Bhagavatam. But somehow or other, I don't know how it is, just some very nice people came that I did the Sunday feast here. So one lady works in a yoga center and somehow brought some people, and they heard the lecture I gave. And then this one very nice lady started to come morning and evening. And then when she Can you just let me know that I'm still online, because I'm not used to this phone? Can someone say hello?
Yes, Maharaj, you are.
Okay. So this very nice lady, and then somehow or other she came up to me after a few of the classes, and I spoke to her. And, you know, it came to that discussion, and I told her that she should pray, you know, et cetera. And then she says, I have been praying. And she kind of felt, I don't know if it's sentiment or what, that her prayers had been answered and that she was getting the answers and instructions that she wanted. So somehow or other, by this desire of Sannyas Thakur, who was completely detached from the world, and therefore his approach to Krishna consciousness was more or less at the level of love from the very beginning. There's four types of people that can come to Krishna consciousness. Chaturvidha bhajanti mam janas sukhatanoja artha artharti jigyasa. There's people who are coming out of distress, out of curiosity, out of economic reasons, or out of knowledge. He's coming out of knowledge. He basically begin at the platform of purity. So he comes, and then they have a very wonderful exchange, and even Babaji Maharaj takes him to meet his guru, who is Pradyumna Brahmacharya, is one of Lord Chaitanya's associates, and he watches the incredible, intimate, loving exchange between the guru and the disciple. And he witnesses this wonderful loving exchange and how it's done. And then the guru of Babaji Maharaj, this presumed brahmachari, he tells Sannyas, this person is your guru. You were very fortunate to have such an exalted soul, and you should learn the Prema Bhavart of Jagannath Danda Pandit under him. And he witnessed all this, and he took it to heart. And then he decides, he's invited, but he decides, yes, I will stay in this ashram, because living with the guru, I am likely to get his instructions. And as our decisions determine our fate or future, our success in life is getting the knowledge we need to respond appropriately to the situation we're in, to extract the fruits of realizations within our life that God is giving us. And by responding to them appropriately, getting those realizations and elevating our life so that our future becomes better. So as an intelligent person, he wants that association. So he has the knowledge on what to do and the discipline in which to do it, jnana and vairagya. Without knowledge, you don't know what to do. Without discipline, you can't do it. So he wants the association of this exalted soul. Specifically, so he already has that discipline to understand what to do. And he has already that deep sincerity in heart, which I many times mention is actually the essence of piety, is wanting truth more than anything else. And truth often comes in the form of an authority of truth that we want to surrender and learn from. And we have the tendency to do that no matter what it means to our life, because accepting knowledge is a very heavy thing, because knowledge dictates our life, and it may dictate that those things that we want we shouldn't have, and those things that we have we shouldn't want. And it may dictate and expose the egotistical conceptions and attachments we have, selfishly and subtly and selfishly. So to really have that level of surrender and open ourselves up to the truth, to the extent that we will change by the truth, it doesn't mean renunciation. Again, I'm very sensitive in presenting this point because so often it's misunderstood. The truth for Arjuna when he surrendered was, you should fight, if that's what you are as a warrior. But that tendency to want to surrender to Guru and Krishna, to want to hear that, to want to be told, I am wrong, this is not the way it should be, and this conception that I have of myself is false, and you are not the best, and this is how one who is the best acts, and this is to want that. So this Sannyas Thakur is extremely sincere. He wants the truth no matter what it may mean for his life. Of course, ultimately, what the truth means to our life is the truth will set us free. But because we are attached to things that are klishta or trouble for us, it's painful to do what's best. Anyway, Sannyas Thakur, he's very, very humble. And he begins to ask. And what he wants to understand is, what is Dharma? And his confusion, what he's distressed about, that different people give different answers. So he wants to know, what is the Nitya Dharma? What is the eternal duty of the living entity? Why do different teachers explain it in such diverse ways? If Dharma is one, why don't all learned teachers cultivate one Dharma? And then the Babaji, of course, before he speaks, he puts himself in the utmost condition of humility by prayer. And he meditates in humility on the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya. And he begins to explain. He said, as far as I know, he said, I'll explain Dharma. And then he begins with a very, very interesting concept. He says, in Sanskrit, an object is called a vastu. And the nature of that vastu is its eternal Dharma. It's what it's for. And it's what it's for in all circumstances. So that the Dharma or nature of something arises from the elementary structure of an object or thing. And that by Krishna's desire, when God's desire, when an object is formed, there is a particular nature inherent in that object. And that nature is the Nitya Dharma. So basically, we are created by God. What he's saying is, by God's desire, we are made of something and we are made for something. And that's what our duty is. And that's the duty, basically saying, of anything, its utility or purpose, whether inert or living, is what it was elementarily constructed for. And then he describes that the nature of an object sometimes becomes altered or distorted. And a change takes place in it, either by the force of circumstance or contact with another object. And then the distorted nature appears to be permanent, as if it was the eternal nature. But it's not. The distorted nature is not the true nature, which is called Svabhav. It's called Nisarg, a nature which has come about by the association of something else. So what he's actually going to explain is, we have an eternal nature, but by some force of circumstance, that nature has been distorted or changed, and has been identified as the real nature. basically, to jump ahead, our real nature is that we are meant for love and service. We are consciousness, which reaches its fulfillment or perfection in love. We are eternally part of God, and eternally we're meant for God's service. We are constructed for that purpose. But somehow or other, by circumstance, that has been distorted or changed. And that distorted nature appears to be our real nature. And what is this distorted nature? I am the controller. I am the enjoyer. My duty is not to be the ungi, the unga, the limb, but to be the ungi, the possessor of limbs. There's a body. The body is the ungi. It's the possessor, and the limbs are the unga. So the duty of the unga is to serve. The duty of the ungi, the possessor of the limbs, is to control its parts and dictate to its parts. But somehow, even though we are the unga, we're the limbs, we have this, somehow our nature has been distorted for us to think that we are not, that we are the center rather than the servants of the center. And it's kind of become fixed. And that's the conception that we have. And it's and spiritual life means, therefore spiritual life means humility, because it means to change that conception. That's the ego. It's the false conception of the it's a false conception that we are the controllers and the world. It's a false conception that this is our world for our enjoyment. The real conception is it's God's world for His enjoyment, because that's His dharma. That's His world. God is the creator and the controller and the enjoyer, and we're meant to serve that. Just as the hand serving the body enjoys the nourishment and fulfillment of the whole body. And then this Prem Das Babaji, he's such a good teacher. He gives an example. And he gives the example of water, whose swabhav or true nature is liquidity. But when the water solidifies due to certain circumstances and becomes ice, then the acquired nature of solidity takes the place of its inherent nature of liquidity. But the acquired nature happens not naturally, but by the force of external circumstances. So somehow or other, our nature that sits within itself, that rests within itself by the force of some external circumstances, changes. And somehow takes the place of the inherent nature. So inherently, the natural thing for us to do is to serve and love. But by force of circumstances, we've adopted a nature of enjoyment and control. And it's so subtle. It's so subtle that even the good qualities that we cultivate get appropriated by the false nature of self-centeredness and selfishness. If you look at it, if you honestly reflect on yourself and on your thinking, you'll see how much your objective in life is to move the world so that it is in line with your personal desires for position, money, whatever it is, not for service. This is our consciousness. It's so subtle. But this nature is not the eternal nature. It's rather a temporary nature. Water is made into ice by external circumstances that have to be maintained. You have to have the refrigerator. You have to raise the temperature. The normal condition is liquidity. So this acquired nature, it's not eternal. It arises because of some cause. And when the cause is no longer effective, the acquired nature vanishes automatically. When you take away the temperature, then the acquired nature of solidity, it vanquishes automatically. So in the same way, when we take away the cause of egotism, then the acquired nature of egotism, it vanishes. However, the swabhav, the nature of something, the liquidity of water or the service of the soul is eternal. It may become distorted. And this is, I'm basically reading what Babaji Maharaj is saying. But it still remains inseparably connected to the object. In other words, the liquidity may become distorted into ice, but that liquidity remains inseparably connected to the object. The same thing that we may become distorted into material consciousness, where we tend to view things as objects for our own desire and control, rather than seeing ourselves as an object for the service of God and others. So, the nature, the swabhav, the natural condition, it may become distorted. The water may become ice, but still, the swabhav remains inseparably connected to the object. And the original nature will certainly become evident again when the proper time and circumstance arrives. The ice will melt in time. You can see it. The water just stays naturally. But the ice in time will melt. So he continues, the swabhav of an object is its nitya dharma, its eternal function. While its acquired nature is naimittika dharma, occasional function. So, what's happening here in the first point, he's answering what is dharma. And he's describing dharma is the swabhav, its natural, eternal nature. And he's making an analogy between ordinary objects, and he gave the example of water and ice, and So our dharma is our eternal function, what we're made of and what we're made for. And that's our nitya dharma. Nitya means eternal. Our eternal duty. And then there is naimittika dharma, which means temporary duty. I'm going to stop now. Are there any questions?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify or confirm that you were saying that our, you know, it changes like the water, the liquidity of water changes to ice, solidifies. Similarly, you were saying that the nature of the soul in certain condition, you know, in the condition of egotism, it changes to the material nature, but actually the nature of the soul never actually ever changes, right? It's just our perception of the nature of the soul that changes.
Well, what the example it gave here is,
otherwise we couldn't say it's eternal.
Well, let's just reflect on the analogy, and I want to read what it said. It says that, you know, just like ice, the nature of that, its swabhav of liquidity still remains inseparable from it. It still remains inseparable from it, even though it's been distorted or changed. You know the liquidity is there. So in the same sense, yes, it's our consciousness has been changed. But it's still inseparable that the desire to love is there. Even in the most egotistical person, they still have a desire in some factor, some understanding of love. It just becomes so narrow and self-serving. But it's still inseparable for the soul. But it definitely becomes distorted. But it's not their eternal condition. Their eternal condition is to serve. And after some time, Brahmanda Brahmate, Konya Bhagavan Jeev, etc., you know, after some time, in time immemorial, then the soul will somehow or other, you know, acquire its real nature. But if the acquired nature, like the water does not have to become ice. There's some water that will never become ice. So solidity is not the eternal nature of water. But liquidity is the eternal nature of water, even when it's ice.
The use of this word consciousness gets a little messy for me because on the one hand we say that the soul is consciousness and we also say that the soul is eternal, never changes. This chapter 2 of the Gita, nothing about it is changeable. Yet here we're saying that the consciousness changes. And so there it becomes a little confusing.
Well, it's kind of like the example is given when the a a child it wants the moon, and the child is given a pot of water, and the moon is reflected in the water. And then the child can't hold the pot, and the pot begins to move. And then the child thinks that the moon is moving, but the moon is actually in the sky steady. So in the same way, somehow or other, the consciousness is reflected on the body. The body is transforming, not the soul. But the soul has the impression it's being transformed. It's just like someone who is the son of a very rich man, and then he forgets it. It doesn't mean that that's not his position. It doesn't mean that that's not his position. And I think also this enters into, I would say, realms of philosophy that are kind of debated even within Vaishnava tradition. You know, it's kind of like someone's in a car and you kind of drive the car, you know what I'm saying? But the movement apparatus is not yourself, it's the machine that you're in. So there's a concept, too, that we're kind of awareness, we're pure awareness, and that that pure awareness is reflected on a body that you know, is thinking, feeling, and willing. But that's one view. But the other view is that the soul itself, if you say that the soul is thinking, right, or willing, or feeling, then does that mean that the soul is transformed? So it seems that the potency of the soul is to remain conscious, right? It's still consciousness. Right, even though it's thinking, and thinking is a transformation. So it's consciousness. It remains the same. Something remains, the moon remains the same. It's reflected in the water. But it's reflected in the water. So it's remaining the same, but the only difference is that analogy that the soul, even though it's remaining steady in identification with something, it feels it's moving. So, I mean, if you want to say that, you know, consciousness is transformed in that way, you can say it. But the very nature of consciousness is something that's eternally transforming. Because consciousness is made aware of things, and it's made aware of different things. So how can it not be transforming in a way? And now people will argue this, but the same thing, how can it not be transforming in some way? But at the same sense, it's remaining steady. It's the same substance. It's the same thing. It's the same consciousness. But it's sometimes described as you know, looking in a mirror, right? It becomes distorted. So is the form distorted? No. The lens is distorted. So somehow the consciousness is looking through a lens, and it has different perceptions, and it reacts in the same way. But the person's body is the same when it looks in the mirror. You say, oh my God, I'm fat. Oh my God, I've lost weight. It's not fat, it hasn't lost weight. But it's thinking that way. So if you want to say the thinking itself is a transformation, no, I like the thing of the mirror. The thinking is not the transformation, because the actual thing's not transforming. You're just perceiving it in that way. And that's what's called Maya, or illusion. To see what is not, or not to see what is there. Okay, Gail?
I have to think about it. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll have to think about it too. These are extremely deep questions. Would anybody else like to ask a question or to say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, it's Vajradhe.
Thank you for listening. I think this first section happens to be a little philosophical, but I think as I speak on it, we'll get more clarity on it. Anyone else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Allegra in Princeton. Thank you for
Allegra,
the call.
Allegra, thank you for listening. We will see you soon. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Sudevi.
Sudevi, great. Sudevi, you'd like to say something? But I'll Skype you. If you send me your number, I can also call you very cheaply, too. So send me your number, okay?
Thank you. Thank you for class, Maharaj.
It's kind of in the afternoon after lunch, so I it's kind of like an athletic event. They have to be in better shape. Okay, thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, Sudevi, I'm going to Skype you now, right after this, I think. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, Ranshikalpa Trivi Sakadasis.